have you have your Bible with you, you may care to have it open at that passage from 1 Samuel chapter 1, although we're not actually going to begin there, so if you are going to follow in the scriptures, you will want to keep your finger in there as we turn to one or two other passages first of all. But we are meeting this morning on what is traditionally called Mothering Sunday, but which has confusingly in more recent years been referred to as Mother's Day. Now, just a quick bit of history for you so you understand why this has come about. Originally, Mothering Sunday goes back hundreds of years, and it was because you had the young members of the family, often as young as 10, being sent off into domestic service at some distance. And it was traditional on what is supposed to be the third, or is it the fourth Sunday in Lent, to give the children a day off so that they can return home in order to spend some time with their families, and especially with their mothers. So it was called Mothering Sunday. Another explanation, and it might have moved one way or the other, is that people, when they went off into domestic service, would then attend the local church. Of course, that would either be Church of England or Roman Catholic. Then every now and again they would take the opportunity to return to their mother church. And so it really had nothing to do with mothers at all. It was returning to mother church. You still have people today referring to the Church of England as mother church and encouraging the likes of us nonconformists to return to mother church. Well, that's a whole other issue, which we won't go into now. But also on Mothering Sunday, whether it was originally a return to Mother Church or a return to mothers, and it got swapped around at various times in history, it was traditional to deliver to their mother a simnel cake. Now, whether the word simnel comes from the Latin word for the kind of flour used, or whether it comes from an argument between one Simon and one Nell, a brother and sister, as to how this particular cake should be made, we haven't got the faintest idea. It's lost in the mists of time. But that's where Mothering Sunday comes from. And it's always been remembered on this day, and it's increasingly become associated with mothers rather than with churches. However, in America in 1905, a lady, Anna Rees Jarvis, died. She had been involved with trying to bring about some kind of reconciliation between the two sides of the American Civil War. And she had at least two daughters, one of whom was Julia Ward Jarvis, who missed her mother greatly and thought it would be a good idea to set aside one day of the year to meditate about mothers and motherhood, especially so that she had a means of remembering her mother and being grateful for her mother. She felt that so often mothers were despised by their children and not appreciated as they should be. And so she began writing letters, she began getting support from ministers, from politicians and all sorts, and increasingly Mother's Day was adopted as a regular holiday in different states until in 1914 it became an official national holiday in America, and it takes place on the second Sunday of May. When Julia Ward Jarvis suggested that white carnations be presented as a symbol of motherhood. So Mother's Day is American, and it's not today, it's in May. But of course, the commercialization of our society has gone on apace, and so it's much easier to produce one design of card for the whole world, or at least the whole English-speaking world, rather than two, to be presented on different dates, and so therefore, in their laziness, the greetings card industry and the flower industry have called it Mother's Day, makes their life easier. And they say that Mother's Day is today in this country, it's just on a different date in other parts of the world. Sadly for Julia Ward Jarvis, when she died at the age of 84, she never became a mother. And from a very early time, observing the commercialization of Mother's Day, she tried to have it stopped. So the most vehement exponent of Mother's Day became the most vehement opponent of Mother's Day. As early as 1924, she was going along and disrupting meetings and trying to destroy cards in shops. She said, no, no, you've missed the point entirely. It wasn't supposed to be a money-making exercise. It was supposed to be an opportunity to remember mothers. Well, one of the problems that we continue to have with regard to Mothering Sunday or Mother's Day is its commercialization. And this time of the year is one of those times, along with the 14th of February, when you suddenly discover that the price of flowers goes through the roof. I'm sure they make most of their profits just before the 14th of February. That's Valentine's Day if you can't work it out. And just before Mother's Day, because they know that people are going to buy flowers most definitely on those dates, even if they don't buy them at any other time of the year. Of course, this completely ignores my wife's birthday and our wedding anniversary, when they can guarantee that flowers will be sold. But one of the problems is not just the commercialization, the problem is the mentality that can go along with setting aside a special day for remembering mothers, whether it be today or whether it be in May. And the problem is that people think, oh right, well, I've done my duty now and I have remembered my mother, so now I can forget about her for the rest of the year. And sadly, that is too often the result of having special days for things. And so people say, right, Christmas is the special day when we remember the birth of Christ. And the rest of the year they forget about the birth of Christ completely. They say, Good Friday is the day when we remember the death of Christ. And the rest of the year they forget about the death of Christ. And Easter Sunday is the day we remember the Lord's resurrection. And they forget about it for the rest of the year. This is the problem with setting aside special days. In fact, if you look at the calendar, you would find that every day is some kind of special day that someone has declared. Have we passed it yet, National No Smoking Day? That's coming up fairly soon. So I think it's coming up sometime this month. But the problem is that then people get past that day and then they forget all about it again. And there's a day for this and a day for that and a day for the other, and it's an opportunity. People think to highlight something. I wonder what September 11th last year was a special day for, and as a consequence, whatever the subject was that was chosen by someone to be a day to remember something, regrets that they ever chose that day. And it will be useless to remember what they want to remember on that day, because for the next several years at least, all we'll hear on that day is reflections on what has happened since September the 11th. So there are great dangers in having special days for remembering things. When we look at the scriptures, we find that although there were special days in the Old Testament, in the New Testament there's only one special day. That special day is Sunday. And it's not any particular Sunday, it is every Sunday. It's the day on which the church should meet together and remember the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ in the Lord's Supper. A time when we can learn from the scriptures, apostolic doctrine, where we can have fellowship together and encourage one another in the faith, and when we can join together in united prayer to God for all the things that concern us, and praying for the extension of God's kingdom. But in spite of the fact that there are these difficulties and problems associated with special days, nonetheless, we do still keep such special days, not because we have to, not because the Bible tells us to, but because there are sometimes useful things that we can remember. Sometimes it does mean that we get extra people here. We have more people here at Christmas than most other times of the year. And so therefore, for that reason, they can be useful. But sadly, not today. But what can we learn with regard to Mothering Sunday? Well, obviously it is a time to consider mothers. We could expand it slightly and talk about what the Bible has to say about parents. And in fact, that is where we're going to start, by turning back to the Ten Commandments. If you turn up the Ten Commandments, that's the first occurrence of them. And for those of you who don't know where it is, that's in Exodus chapter 20. And we have listed here the Ten Commandments, that is the covenant that God made with the nation of Israel. And when you read through, you get down to verse 12, and verse 12 says, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving to you." And so here we have the statement from God. It is part of the covenant that God established that the people of Israel, with whom the covenant was made, should honour their father and mother. And a reason was attached to it, and a promise was attached to it. And it was this, that your days may be long in the land. If you don't honour your father and mother, not only is that sin, but it will be a cause of me removing you from the land. And the fact that Israel was removed from the land in 587 BC, you can say that one of the reasons was because of the way that the people of Israel were treating their parents. And you can say that one of the reasons why Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple demolished, wiped out, and the Jews scattered to the four winds in AD 70 was because of their behaviour towards their parents. We do read in the New Testament where Jesus reproves the Pharisees for their hypocrisy. And he says, "Now you say that a son can get away from his duties by saying he has dedicated himself to the Lord." But this was just something they had invented. And their invented tradition was then used to override the clear teachings of the scriptures. Honour your father and your mother. And so serious does God regard this, if we just turn over to the next chapter, chapter 21, and verse 15, we read there that he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Now, looking round supermarkets today, if these children had been living in ancient Israel, well, they wouldn't have had very long lives. They would have been put to death. It is a very sad observation of modern society, that modern society despises what God says. It's no longer honour your father and your mother. It is no longer respect the hoary head, that is, the person with white hair, i.e. someone who's old, someone who has wisdom, someone who has lived life, has made mistakes and has learned from them. No, get rid of those. Let's get rid of all the old people. And this has always been the way down through the centuries. Perhaps it's the post-war generations where this has become more and more extreme. And what the old have said has been totally despised. No, we're young. We know better. And never listen to the advice of their elders. Never listen to the advice from their parents. And consequently, they despise them. And is it any wonder that society is in the mess it is now? And the interesting thing is that immediate post-war young generation is now becoming old. And they're still trying to behave as if they're young. And they're still trying to have it all. And they're still despising the words of those who are older than them. But now they've got a problem. Because there's a younger generation which has the same attitude towards them as they had towards their elders, their parents. And they're having problems and difficulties with it because they're saying, "But look, we did this, we made mistakes, we've learned from our lessons, we don't want you making the same mistakes." "Oh no, we know better than you," say the young. Here is but one example of the sinfulness of the human heart. God says one thing and the human heart says, "Not interested. We know better than God does. We will do what we want." And so mother and father are not honoured. They are not respected, but rather they are despised. And yet, we might think to ourselves, why bother having children? Those without children often say, I'm glad I haven't got any screaming brats like you've got. Commenting to a poor mother who's got three children walking behind her and another one in a pushchair, and she doesn't know what to do because they're all screaming their heads off. I'm glad I haven't got children, they say. I couldn't put up with that. But it also has to be said that for those of us who are parents, that there are great delights and joys in being a parent. Yes, there are problems, there are trials, there are difficulties. But you ask the majority of parents, if you had the opportunity in some way to reverse time, would you not have children? And given that you have more than one, would you have less than the number you in fact did have? And I think the answer would almost invariably go something like this. Well, yes, I can see that there would have been great advantages in not having children or in having less children. There are things that I could have done that I haven't done, or things I could have done better. But given such a choice, I would still have children and I would still have the same number. That is what the majority would say, because there are joys in parenthood that are indescribable and they are not understandable by anyone except those who have children. I always remember a friend commenting on this, that when his father told him off, when his father disciplined him, and he didn't like it and he thought his father was just being mean and rotten, but as soon as he had children, I don't know how many he actually had in the end, but I know he had at least two. Started off with twins. He commented one day that he now understood why his father dealt with him as he did, because his father loved him. He now understood that. He'd never really understood that before. Because now he sees in his own children the need for discipline, and the children don't like it, but the children had to receive it for their good. If they didn't have it, then they would get into a worse state than they were. And so, those who are parents, the majority would say, yes, they are delighted that they are parents. In spite of all the heartaches, in spite of all the pain, in spite of all the problems, in spite of all that they've had to give up in order to care for children. Children are extremely expensive, not just in terms of what they cost you, but in what you are not able to earn for mothers who stay at home, what they're not able to earn. Huge sums of money are given up because of children. That's not saying that they're not worth it. It shows just how much they are worth and how much they are valued by their parents. But there was a time when childlessness was considered a curse. We have it in this chapter that we read. Here we have this man, he had two wives. How he could manage with two wives, I can't understand. Why Mormons think polygamy is so wonderful, and even though they don't outwardly at least practice it, yet they still would like to. Why they consider polygamy so wonderful, having one wife as a full-time job, how you can have more than one is quite beyond me. But anyway, this man had two wives. One of them produced for him several, many children, sons and daughters. But the other wife, Hannah, the Lord had closed her womb. And in the distorted thinking of sinful people, when God withholds some blessing from you, this is clearly because God is seeking to punish you. So therefore you have sinned in some way or other. But on the other hand, here's this other woman, got lots of children, the Lord has blessed me, so therefore I'm good, I'm in God's favour. And clearly that doesn't follow. The passage itself tells us this doesn't follow. That she did know blessing from God because she was a godly woman. We're going to consider in a moment the reasons why God withheld children from her for so long. But we need to emphasize this point at the moment. If you read the book of Job, why did Job suffer? Because of his sin? No. There was another reason that was hidden from Job and from his three friends. And so we can never say that when some unpleasant thing happens, it might be something not happening, as in the case of childlessness, or some positive infliction of unpleasantness, such as aircraft flying into a building, or being run over by a bus or whatever, we cannot say that this has happened because of God's judgment upon that person or those people. Because there are so many examples in the scriptures of the godly suffering and the wicked getting away with it. And this is what should have been learned by Peninnah, the other wife. Instead of despising Hannah, instead of mocking her and persecuting her, she should have just treated her normally. Perhaps she should also have gone so far as to have prayed for Hannah that the Lord might open her womb. But here we find this woman, a godly woman, because of her response. Now, when something unpleasant happens to you, what's the first thought that plops into your mind? Very often it will be this. This is God's fault. Curse God! I remember, within a few weeks of being converted, I was in bed, I'd just woken up, and I had resolved I was going to turn up on time for all the lectures, because I hadn't been. The previous term, I had managed to just about get up in time for the third lecture. I was spending far too long in bed, so I decided, having been converted, that I would now attend all the lectures. And I woke up this morning, and I looked at the clock, and I misread the clock. I thought the clock said 9:30, which is when lectures started. And this voice plopped into my head and said, "See? That's what being a Christian does for you. Curse God." And I thought to myself, no, that's wrong. I shouldn't curse God. Where did that thought come from? I thanked God. I thought I was foolish, but I thanked God. I thought, this is my fault. Then I looked at the clock again. I'd misread it. It was 8:30, not 9:30. And I'd only overslept by 30 minutes. Instead of 1.5 hours. And right from almost the beginning, I was reminded that just because unpleasant things happen, just because things seem to go wrong, doesn't mean it's God's curse upon you, doesn't mean it's God's judgment. These things happen. God allows them to happen. God sometimes causes them to happen in order that we can learn things. And I learned that morning. Just because, as I initially thought, things had gone wrong, it's not God's fault. It's not a cause of cursing God. Rather, the opposite. It's a cause to go to God. It's a cause to seek God. It's a source of inspiration to seek God's face and to plead with Him for overturning the unpleasantness or for pouring out some great blessing. But this should be our response to the fact that we are so few. It should drive us to God, to call out to God and plead with Him, to bring the Spirit and convince people of sin, and to bring them to Christ, and having been brought to Christ, and then they will join with us. This is the effect it had on Hannah. What does Hannah do? Hannah is weeping. Verse 6, her husband says, "Why do you weep? Why do you not eat?" And in bitterness of soul we read, she prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish in verse 10. And she made a vow. Oh, I'm not saying that every time that we are seeking God's face, we should try and make a vow to God. Although it might reflect what we really think in our hearts, the true state of our hearts. But vows are not required because there is always the tendency and the temptation to think in our minds that if we make a vow, then that's our part of the bargain, and now God will fulfill His part of the bargain. But that doesn't follow, because it implies that we are dealing with an equal. We're not. There's nothing we can offer to God that will persuade God to do what we ask him. God will only do things because God chooses to do things. And yet he still calls upon us to pray. But she made a vow that if she was given a son, that son would be dedicated to the Lord for his whole life. He would be a Nazarene. It's not actually stated here, but we learn from elsewhere what a Nazarene is. A Nazarene is someone dedicated to God who never has his hair cut. And her vow is that not a razor shall come upon his head. And God heard her, and God answered. And so she knew the great joy of motherhood, of holding a small child in her arms, of suckling it, and bringing it to a state where it is independent of her. That is, when it becomes weaned, it's no longer dependent upon her milk, and it can begin to eat solid food. And so she then did as she had promised, as she had vowed to God. And she took the young child, whom she had named Samuel, and she took him to the temple, and he then was dedicated to God's service throughout his whole life. So the apparent curse was shown not to be a curse at all, but she knew the blessing of children. You know, I have those verses that speak throughout the Old Testament of the blessedness of children. And it speaks of a person having their quiver full of them. Of course, we are now under a different covenant. We are under the new covenant. And while children are still a blessing, of a greater blessing are spiritual children. We cannot guarantee that our children will become Christians. We may only be populating hell, which is a dreadful thought. Having children is a very, very serious business. We should not enter into having children lightly and think, oh, I just want children. We've known children, people in the past, teenagers, teenage girls who said, I'm going to get myself pregnant. Couldn't care less about who makes me pregnant. I just want to get pregnant so I can have a child. So there will be someone who loves me. What a sad situation that child is in, but it considers itself unloved by its parents and anybody else. It's going to have a child to love it. And how disappointed that girl is going to be when the child grows and despises its mother and discovers that that is not a reason for having children. But we should be careful. We should counsel carefully. When people say, I'm thinking of having children, we should say, well, first of all, there needs to be two of you in a permanent union to bring up that child or those children, and to pour love and affection upon them, and to teach them the truth, and to point them in the ways of righteousness, point them to Christ. But you cannot guarantee that they will become Christians. You might just be producing fodder for hell. It's a very sobering thing to become a parent. It's a very sobering thing to bring them up and to instruct them in the way. So let us just consider a few brief things in closing. Just because people today choose to have children doesn't mean that they should be despised. Some people take this choice, they take it for very good reasons. Some take it for selfish reasons. Oh, I just want lots of money. But some people think, if you have children, they take up a huge amount of time. I want to go off and be a missionary. It would be unfair to the children for me to be away as a missionary in some distant country where life is hard and difficult. And so therefore, either I will not marry, or if I do marry, I won't have children, in order that I can concentrate on the work of the gospel. Well, that is a commendable thing. It's not to be despised. If that is the attitude, it should be applauded. Indeed, Paul suggests in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that it's better to be unmarried. It's better to remain single because of the spiritual work that can be done. We could follow on from that and to say, well, there is an intermediate stage because it's possible to be married and not have children. It wasn't much of a choice at the time Paul wrote, it was almost impossible not to have children if you were married. Today we are able to make that choice. And so it's possible to be married, and both partners of a marriage are able to labour in the gospel together without the concern of children. We shouldn't think that people who, as Christians, make such a choice are abnormal or peculiar or odd or weird. We should also seek to instruct young people in the wisdom of the scriptures and to point them to Christ and to teach them to honour their parents, to honour their mother in particular. Fathers tend to be far more thick-skinned and less emotional than mothers, and so to be despised by your children, it's still hurtful, it's still painful, but it doesn't affect a father as much as it affects a mother. We should teach them to take more care of their parents and especially of their mothers. And we should seek always, in difficult circumstances — it's easy in the easy times, but in difficult circumstances, we need to learn from Hannah that it should drive us to God, to call upon God, to answer positively in whatever the particular situation happens to be, and to be thankful to God, whatever the answer might be. You might desperately want something, desperately want it, and you plead with God, and the answer is no. We need to learn to be thankful to God, to understand that God knows us better than we know ourselves. God knows what is best for us, what is for our good, and sometimes God takes us through very painful, very unpleasant experiences, because greater good for us will come out of it. And also, our response in such circumstances is an illustration of the true state of our hearts. You find someone where something really unpleasant happens, they can respond in one of two ways. Either they can go to God and submit themselves to God and to God's will, or they can turn round and they can spit in God's face and say, "I'm not interested in you, God. If that's the way you're going to treat me, I'm not interested." Well, how foolish that is. That's arrogant. That's proud. That's saying, "I know better than you do, God." And it indicates that a person's heart is not right with God. Though they profess to be a Christian, they're not really. And it's taken something unpleasant to bring the state of their hearts to light. Oh, that it were possible for people to discover truly what the state of their hearts was without something unpleasant happening. Oh, that we lived in a world where there was no sin. Oh, that we lived in a world where there was no corruption, where there was no hardness of heart, where every day was a glorious day, and we were never reminded of human sin and of death. Well, we can look forward to such a time. Such a time is coming. We don't know when, but it is in the future, when Christ will return and renew the world, and this earth will be transformed into a world that is far, far better than this one, more glorious, in which will dwell the redeemed of God, those who have put their trust in Christ. Is this what we're looking forward to? Is this where our hope lies? I hope that it is. And I hope it is a cause of joy and gladness, a cause of rejoicing, and that it is our desire to take as many others with us, and that we will seek to persuade others of the glories of the gospel of Christ, and of the love and grace of our God and King.